Hi everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department Podcast. My name is Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, graphic design, publishing, animation, and other creative fields about their beginnings, their successes, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, my guest is Amanda Burden, curator at the Brandywine River Museum of Art. Imagine a job in which you drive through Wyeth Country to a renovated 19th century grist mill where some of the greatest illustrations ever made are at your fingertips. Among other topics, we talk about the Brandywine's history, its mission, and its collection. Of course, you can't talk to the Brandywine curator without talking about the Wyeths and Piles and several dozen other illustrators. And Amanda explains how the Brandywine literally creates space for women in illustration. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm listening and setting my sound stuff.
Settings. I have this same setup I used for a different podcast, and you know, they had set me and said, okay, lower the mic because your peas are popping. And so I'm trying to do that all the same, but I do talk loud. So
So first of all, thank you so much for wanting to be on this podcast.
Absolutely.
I sincerely appreciate it. As someone who is an illustration educator and just a total nerd of illustration history, of course, I'm like, you know, every now and then I just keep thinking about like, who else should be on the podcast? And I'm kind of from the area. And when the Brandywine Museum when my brain started, like the synapses eventually got to the Brandywine Museum, I was like, oh, right. Yeah, I should talk to somebody over there.
You should also put the Lucas Museum on your list.
I have, and I am trying to get my dream of all dreams is, as someone who was born in 1977 and grew up on Star Wars, is obviously, and is a huge illustration fan, of course, would love to have George Lucas on the podcast to talk not about Star Wars, but about his appreciation for illustration.
Narrative art.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, I don't listen to too many podcasts. As a matter of fact, I only just started listening to some during the quarantine. And so I'm still trying to figure out the different styles and approaches that people are taking.
I started this, a year and change ago. And I guess it never occurred to me to do anything other than sitting down with someone and chatting. Like, I just see this as a virtual. As much as I would love to sit with you at the Brandywine, overlooking the creek, having a cup of coffee.
Obviously. Surrounded by MC Wyeth's work.
Oh my God. Are you kidding me? You're talking about heaven right now. Obviously, that's not a possibility at the moment. So we're here. And this is how it's a virtual chat over coffee is how I see these interviews anyway. How are you doing? I usually start off of late, it seems, just with a sort of a COVID check-in with our guests. And how have you been faring?
Well, I'm working for an art museum, realizing that all the intentions we have to educate public and to bring works of art to a level that people can, you know, access and come and see and learn about. And that's a whole different ballgame now that public events, visiting places outside your home, and considering what kinds of artworks are even, you know, important in a current moment has really changed how an art museum curator is working right now. And so there's a lot of virtual and there's a lot of new media being learned.
We're going to get to that. Before we do, though, I'd like to start off with you and who you are. We'll talk about Mr. Wyeth and all the Wyeths and others in a sec, but where are you from?
Well, originally I am from not that far from the Brandywine, from Berks County, Pennsylvania. And so I grew up in rural Pennsylvania, and I used to drive by the Brandywine on my way to college when I'd come back and forth to the University of Delaware. But the secret is I never stopped and went inside.
Oh my gosh.
Little did I know I would end up working there, but it was on the route that I would take to college. So every day or every trip, I'd drive by and say, there's the Brandywine. It's got the millstone out front.
Yep. It's on Route 1, right?
Yes, it's right on Route 1. And as a matter of fact, my previous museum job was also at a museum on Route 1, but in Connecticut. So it's sort of just, I don't know, 300 miles down the road.
It is the same Route 1, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And I think it goes all the way down to Florida, if I'm not mistaken.
I know. It's like the pre-95.
What did you study at UD?
Oh, I was an art history and a art history major and a printmaking minor. So, you know, I think it's the story of many an art historian is that we really wanted to make art, and we got to a point sometimes earlier, sometimes later in a career where we realized it takes a certain amount of talent. I mean, you can work really hard, but the talent isn't there. Yeah. And so, you know, as a student, I really liked making art and I wanted to stay involved. And it absolutely was completely natural for someone who wanted to be an art historian to study printmaking, because frankly, having made lithographs and screen prints and all these other techniques, it's such a help to, you know, explaining, understanding, identifying the works in my current job.
Yep. As an example, I had Stephanie Plunkett on the podcast, curator of the Norman Rockwell Museum.
Yeah.
She went to Pratt and had, some kind of an illustration career for a second, and then switched right over to, being a curator.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
And there are a lot of conveyances or parallels like that. A lot of working artists work in the museum field as well as our art handlers, and you know, it's knowing all the aspects of creating, making, and showing art that are helpful.
Yeah, I think if I were to do it, doing a little research for this episode and just thinking about museum studies, living now around here, where the Brandywine is just a stone throw away, and you have the Delaware Art Museum. I mean, that's just, you know, just one of the single greatest collections of American illustration is there. There's so much going on around this area. And so I was like, man, I should have rethought my undergrad and studied art history and learned to be a curator.
You know, one of our strongest allies really in contemporary illustration is MICA there in Maryland. Various, you know, their students come and visit. We've actually commissioned some recent graduates from MICA to do illustration work for the museum. And so it's nice to have this kind of nest of illustration fans all in the area, practitioners, historians, all of the above.
Yeah. You know, the term mall rat or teenagers just hang around the mall. I was a MICA rat. I was a quick light rail. No, but I lived just not that far, like a 25-minute light rail ride away. I just thought I would go to MICA.
Yeah.
And then I didn't. I went to RISD instead.
Oh, I used to teach at RISD. I didn't know that. No, so I was going to mention that. You know, there are a few places, like I'm sure I did apply to SCAD before I thought I was going to be an art historian or was sure. And RISD was also, you know, kind of a dream school. So I ended up doing my graduate work in Providence at Brown, and that allowed me to work in the RISD Museum and do some teaching at RISD.
Wow. I won't ask you how old you are, but I'm just going to go ahead and assume, probably incorrectly, that you and I are the same age. And if that's the case, you and I probably hung around at the RISD Museum at the same time.
I was just thinking when you gave your dates there that, you were very likely a student when I was a student.
Yes. And I was also, I took Italian at Brown. Wow. We were probably at the same party.
Connections
continue,
right?
Oh, of course. I was, as a high school art student, SCAD was also in the picture. They had a representative had come to the art department where I was and showed interest in me and my work. And at the time, this was in the 90s, and SCAD was just kind of
hanging
its,
on,
getting its foothold. You know,
yep,
it was a very good school, but it was relatively new. And
exactly,
yeah, RISD just, I was like, all right, RISD was founded in 1877. SCAD was founded like 5 minutes ago.
But, you know, either way, I have applied more than once for a job at SCAD over the years, too. I would still love to live in Savannah.
Amanda, shall I continue our connection? I promise the listeners this is all completely unplanned.
I've never spoken to you before.
Yeah. I fairly recently applied to a position at SCAD. Maybe not recently, but
yeah.
Within some decent amount of time, and didn't get that job. It's okay.
Yeah, no, I never got a job there either.
What the hell, SCAD?
It's not like I turned them down.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. The connections continue, and this will be the last one. And I promise to the listeners, we're moving on. Like half of my wife's family went and or goes to UD.
Yeah, we always think that around the Brandywine, especially, it's like a UD mafia. I mean, whether you're on the museum side or on the conservancy side, our conservancy students or employees often went to University of Delaware as well. It's not that far away.
No, and they have an excellent art department and design
department.
Yeah, they do.
And excellent art history. As a matter of fact, that's what got me to University of Delaware. Is one of the largest, or rather oldest, art history departments that really focused on American art. A lot of schools focused on, you know, the big broad history and the Italian Renaissance and all of these things. But I was interested in American production and also not necessarily always just fine art. I liked craft and design and all of those elements. Yeah. And University of Delaware was really open to, I studied chicken coops at some point, you know, this is the University of Delaware way that everything.
Oh, yeah. Well, go Blue Hens. So
yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
all right. So let's go on to the fact that you are a curator at the Brandywine Museum, and if I may, that collection includes the work of, you know, Newell Converse Wyeth, otherwise known as N.C. Wyeth, Andrew and Jamie Wyeth, Howard Pyle, Maxfield Parrish, Jesse Wilcox Smith, Charles Dana Gibson, Rockwell Kent, Horace Pippin. I mean, I could go on for about 55 minutes. On top of that, the Brandywine owns and operates N.C. Wyeth's home and studio, as well as the Kerner, I think I'm pronouncing that right, farm,
that's right.
Which inspired, you know, hundreds of Andrew Wyeth pieces. On top of that, the Brandywine is located on the Brandywine River, or creek, depending on who you talk to.
Or crick, depending on who you
talk to. Oh, yeah. Delaware. Delaware's comeback.
Yeah.
So crick, Delaware crick. The building is a renovated 19th century grist mill, and the grounds are an unparalleled botanic garden. Mm-hmm. Not only is the Brandywine, I like to call it a mecca of American illustration, but starting in the 60s, its mission, its sort of beginnings, was rooted in environmental protection and, you know, protecting large swaths of land in Pennsylvania's Chester County, which is where I live, Delaware County, as well as Delaware's New Castle County, from, you know, rampant development. All of that is to say, it's a pretty neat place.
It is. And, you know, when we try and in a quick way explain how a place can be so interested in the art of a region and so interested in the land and the water of a region, you walk into our galleries and you see paintings by people like William Tross Richards, who painted in Chester County in this Hudson River School style. Mm-hmm. And you realize that because of the actions of the Conservancy and other Conservancy groups, some of the land in Chester County still looks like it did when William Tross Richards painted these things in the 19th century.
Yeah.
So it kind of preserves not just culture, but also natural resources as well under our mission.
Yeah. I assume the community is highly involved and highly invested and fully appreciative of the Brandywine Museum and all of its efforts, both with, you know, our art and environmental conservation.
Yeah, I mean, we have such a a robust force of volunteers. It's amazing how many people in the community really are or want to be or continuing to be involved in the museum, keeping us going, helping us in any way they can, right, both on the museum side and on the conservancy side. That the neighborhood that we're in, I think, and I live in Chester County now as well, I can think we can say that our residents and our neighborhood really appreciates both of our aspects of our mission.
Yeah. Do you have folks ever showing up to the museum going, I think I have a Howard Pyle in my attic?
Every day.
What?
Yeah.
Are you? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You have to share some story or two about that.
Oh my goodness. It's usually, thankfully, these days, people calling or sending email pictures, okay, but mm-hmm, the kind of phone call that says, hi, there's someone down here in the parking lot, and they have some artwork for you to look at. And, you know, you have to, absolutely have to listen, pay attention, go and see all of these things, because mm-hmm, this stuff turns up, you know. We just had, and it's not necessarily a famous illustrator, but a painting by the artist John Nagle, who's really known as a portraitist. And someone called and said, I have a landscape by John Nagle. And we thought, that guy? And then they said, and it was painted on the Brandywine battlefield. Really? And then there's an inscription on the back that explains, and it's like a view of the Battle of Brandywine, done after the fact, actually right around the commemoration about 100 years later. Mm-hmm. But, you know, because we have this historic aspect as well with the Revolutionary War battle that took place literally all around us, we get all sorts of Brandywine related things. I mean, I have a list right now, and I'm absolutely so grateful for the number of people who have collected over the years. A lot of illustration ends up in private collections. As you mentioned, there's not that many, you know, big museum collections of illustration. And as people are, you know, either divesting of their collections or doing their estate planning, we are really benefiting from gathering up those history of illustration pieces that are coming. I just looked today at a bequest that's coming into us with some of those major illustrators that you just mentioned. And it was just like, these just arrived. Someone wants to give them to us. So especially in our area, people would buy these things like at Howard Pyle Studios in Wilmington, yeah, and keep them in their home. And, you know,
God.
Only wish that, you know, some of these things, you know, the stories that come in of people who knew the Wyeths or people who were art students. And, you know, my grandmother has this painting. She bought it from Howard Pyle for like $25.
Oh my gosh.
Is that something your museum is interested in?
That alone would get me up out of bed in the morning.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
who's going to show up today with what?
I know, exactly. And
wow.
So one of the things I just looked at today, and as an illustrator, and you'll appreciate this, is an advertisement for Lux soap.
Okay.
And so, but it's a full oil painting done for an advertisement. So this is the days, of course, you know, when fine artists were doing full oil paintings to advertise soap.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a slice of history as well to see how advertising and illustration has evolved and grown, and what the remnants of that can line museum after museum wall.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you have a PhD, right?
I do.
In what exactly? Art history?
Yeah, the history of art and architecture. So I did have had quite a bit of architecture history training at Brown, and that's something that I taught while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of like the University of Delaware art history program really is a total view of the paintings, the sculpture, the architecture, the material mm-hmm. culture, the visual culture. Brown was part and parcel. If you were studying the paintings, you would study the architecture as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, you know, with the Italian Renaissance, you're not just studying Michelangelo's frescoes or marble sculptures, but also what
you know,
managed
Renaissance
to build.
There.
Yeah.
Well, and when I did that program, my focus was on women artists mm-hmm. in American culture, and particularly women who in the period right after the Civil War, really had no chance, possibility, no promise of ever being successful artists in the commercial sense or in the, you know, in the sense of being collected by museums, that these women nevertheless went abroad and got the finest art training that they could receive. Yeah. And found ways, like RISD, they founded museums, they founded art clubs, they were art teachers. So there was this wave of women art students after the Civil War who were looking for ways to make their name in the art world. And, you know, it's one of the things that attracts me at the Brandywine is how many women illustrators we can include and how women worked their way into that story.
Oh, we're going to get to that. I have a huge question on that. Before we get to that, though, I want to stick with being a curator of any museum, but obviously specifically with the Brandywine. There are several questions here. I wanted to ask you, my brain is just like, ask her this. You get to see drawings and paintings from the greats in fine art and illustration up close and very personal. What exactly are you seeing for... Specifically, like, you know, did N.C. Wyeth leave pipe tobacco in his art, you know, or I heard, you know, Stephanie said that Rockwell used a drying agent, which at this point, I'm sure is cracking his paintings. What are you seeing? Are you seeing little doodles? And I don't know, are there little secrets inside these paintings?
There are. I mean, because we have the privilege of looking up close, and don't tell too many people, but sometimes I touch paintings. today I did it, but you know, clean hands, all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But especially in consultation with conservators, I love finding those little secret bits. So, there's a Grandma Moses painting in our collection, right? And so when she would paint snow, she would, of course, use her white paint and brushes, but she liked to get a little glisten and sparkle to the snow. In later years, she used actual glitter sometimes to put it on the paint. But very early on, like in the 1940s, she used a hair product. So women wouldn't just use hairspray. They'd have this dusting powder they'd put on their hair, and it was really like talc or mica, and it would shimmer just a little bit if you had an extra fancy hairstyle. Mm-hmm. And she used that in her snow. And so you can find her, you know, snow-covered landscapes sometimes have, and ours has, little flakes of mica that were hair care products.
Wow.
And, you know, I kind of geek out when you find something like a fingerprint, or there's a, in one of our Horace Pippin paintings is a brush or hair from the brush. And, you know, but working in a historic property like Brandywine, we have the whole studio there. I mean, the brushes, the paints, everything. So it's the evidence on the painting, but then in these special studio spaces that you can like sit in the chair that N.C. Wyeth sat in.
You know, to stick with Grandma Moses for one quick second. If anyone's interested, her full name is Anna Mary Robertson Moses. She didn't start her creative career until her 70s. And the reason she did that is because she had arthritis, and she, you know, she was, I guess, getting up there in age to sort of say it indelicately, but decided to use art as a way of, you know, keeping her hands moving and reducing the pain and whatnot. And she used coffee cans as her paints, as like holding her paints, and mayonnaise jars were caps for her palettes. And she passed when she was 101. So she had about a 30-year art career starting in her 70s. And she was discovered by some art collector who ended up in her town. She had like a piece in a pharmacy window. Yeah. And
that's how Horace Pippin started too, actually. He had paintings in a department store, or not a department, a little store window, a shop window. And he was discovered in that way.
Yeah. And I think he also went to doing something creative after the war. Yes. He was hit with a sniper bullet. And I think, and I'm not sure which arm, I think is right, but his drawing, his painting arm. And he was never the same after that. He used art as a way of therapy. And was discovered.
Very similar, to Grandma Moses. You know, she wasn't working as hard in the fields, but she could still exercise her hands in that way.
Yeah.
And what's great about Grandma Moses, I always think about her. So that was the first major purchase that I helped to coordinate at the Brandywine, was the Grandma Moses painting that we have. And it really struck me when I was doing presentations and kind of talking up this painting and doing lectures, how she really was so far ahead of her time in terms of the marketing of her work, because she had a gallery, she owned a piece of her own, you know, business, Grandma Moses Enterprises, that put her on calendars and advertisements and cookie tins and everywhere. And she marketed that. I mean, Andy Warhol would be proud of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, she, again, started in her 70s. She was interviewed by Edward R. Murrow. She received Grandma Moses Day. She was memorialized by President Kennedy. She had a fantastic career. And and it all was purely, I don't know, not naive. That's not the right word.
No.
Her own, like completely unfiltered, her own just sort of take on depicting sort of rural scenes and,
You know. Without burden bias, of consciousness.
The
burden
of,
thinking, what does the art world want, or how are the most famous painters painting? It was totally her own vision. And seemingly without self-judgment that said, oh, this isn't good enough, or, you know, other people are better at it. And I think she was super inspirational to artists that came after her that actually went ahead with, like you said, almost consciously naive styles, because Grandma Moses opened the door to an appreciation of a style of art that wasn't just imitation of an old master.
Right. Speaking of Grandma Moses, we mentioned women, or you mentioned women in illustration. So far during this chat, we've mentioned a number of illustrators. Very few of them have been women. Only one of them is black, Horace Pippin. But there was Violet Oakley, Anna Whalen Betts, Ethel Franklin Betts, Ellen Bernard Thompson Pyle, Olive Rush, Blanche Grant, Alice Barber Stevens. I mean, people always talk about Howard Pyle. Do you talk about Ellen Pyle, who was tremendous. And Catherine Pyle, his sister, was also very good. It seems as if these artists are now getting their time and attention and wall space that they deserve. And maybe they have for some time, but it always wasn't the case. So how are you approaching all of that?
Actually, that was one of the things, because I came to the Brandywine with this special interest and background in studying women artists. I knew some of the names, the Red Rose Girls. Those were definitely familiar to me. But being in the world of the Brandywine and this Pyle illustration tradition, I've been able to look more closely at some of those other names that you mentioned. Like, we have Olive Rush, we have we've just a host of other women artists who studied with Pyle. And so one of the things that I made me realize is that Pyle, unlike other teachers, was not concerned whether someone was male or female to be in his class. And he started so many careers for women artists and illustrators, just because he lacked the prejudice that other places had. And I think that when it comes to seeing their work, especially these days, one of the things that's biased that along the way has been our desire to show, you know, and people's interest in seeing the illustrations from these, very well-known stories like Treasure Island, right? Or Revolutionary War stories. And that's just not the realm that women gravitated towards after they had studied with Pyle, you know, and probably maybe they wanted to do that, but they were sort of relegated more towards children's books and greeting cards and the craft aspects. The Philadelphia School of Design for Women trained women to do things like book binding and wallpaper design, you know, that were tangential and adjacent to what the male artists were doing.
Right.
But, you know, we're seeing, and I'm able to, in my position as curator, always make sure there's women represented in the gallery, in the illustration gallery. And we can then make that part of the discussion about why is it that the women's illustrations are children's books,
right,
and men's illustrations are for, like, you know, Field and Stream.
Yeah.
The country gentleman probably right. never had a woman do a cover.
Yeah. I mean, in Ellen Pyle's case, she was one of Pyle's greatest students, but she had mm-hmm. to abandon illustration to become a full-time mother. And in her words, the absorbing task of raising four children put artwork in the background for a time. It wasn't until her husband passed that she became a full-time illustrator with the help of Howard Pyle's sister, Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
Catherine Pyle took Ellen's portfolio up to New York, got her some jobs, and Ellen Pyle was able to raise her family with her illustration work.
Yeah.
You know, and this is something that, like, this, had the roles been reversed, had Ellen's name been, you know, I don't know, George Pyle.
Yeah.
Maybe we'd be studying about it in art school. We'd be talking about it on social media all the time.
Yeah, that's obviously one of the things that in my general studies of women artists, 19th century in particular, realizing that it was made very clear to women if they wanted to study art to be successful, and I'm sure this goes for other fields as well, but if they wanted to be successful, they had to not have a traditional marriage. They had to not have traditional child rearing duties. And so often, as the case that a woman that does make some form of successful career has those artistic relationships. Her father is an artist, her husband is an artist, and it took that kind of open-mindedness, you know. And in the Wyeth family, of course, there's Caroline, and Henriette, who were raised in the same environment that Andrew was raised in, but much less known to the general public today.
Right. One other illustrator that we haven't mentioned is Eleanor Abbott.
Yes, we have a few works by her, as a matter of fact.
Oh my gosh. If anyone's interested, if anyone, you know, when you hear people, how do I want to phrase this? When illustrators who are interested in fantasy art cite influences, they'll cite folks, and, you know, rightly so, they'll say something like Duloc or Arthur Rackham, but not Eleanor Abbott, even though when you look at her work, it is right there. Right there with those guys.
Yeah. And some of those fantasy, I'm trying to think, I don't want to confuse her with somebody else, but leading out from like a children's book, but in a fantasy realm. And what's interesting about the collection that we have of her works, and this is the case for many of the illustrators we hold, we have works that aren't well known because they weren't illustrations. They were works done privately. There's very delicate portraits and personal paintings, we call them, with N.C. Wyeth. So there's two sides to all of these illustrators' lives and works, too.
Yeah. Another interesting little point about all of this is, you know, we talk about the Society of Illustrators all the time, but we don't talk about the Plastic Club.
Oh, yeah.
And the Society of Illustrators forever was dominated by men, was known as a, you know, boys' club. And I'll stop there. until recently, past couple decades.
Yeah.
The Plastic Club, members included Jesse Wilcox Smith and Abbott and others, Violet Oakley, was a organization led by women to promote promote professional opportunities and promote equity for women. It was a women's only club supporting women artists for a century. Men didn't show up until, I think I might have my decade
late.
Wrong, like 90, in the 90s, 1990s?
Yeah, late.
Late, real late.
Yeah. It's funny, I was just, you say no one talks about the Plastic Club, but in our circles, people do, right?
Yeah, yeah,
so
I know.
I just had a conversation this morning with a curator from the Pennsylvania Academy, and we were talking about the Plastic Club, because in my current exhibition, which is on the suffrage movement and the visual culture of the suffrage movement, there is a poster that we've put on display that's advertising some events. It's beautifully illustrated poster of a classical form and the Liberty Bell and sunrise and, you know, everything thrown at it. And it's advertising the suffrage plays that are going to be put on. And when you read the details and you read the fine print, how can I get involved? Where can I go? What theater will it be at? The notes in the poster say that the tickets are on sale at the Plastic Club. So it had, and I'm sure one would dig into this and find, it had more than just advancements for women in the field of art at its core as well. Advancements for women in all fields of life was probably a better way to describe this sisterhood at the Plastic Club as well.
Yeah. Part of the Plastic Club's motto, by the way, all passes, art alone, enduring, stays with us.
There you go.
Amazing. I have a question about N.C. Wyeth and Ellen Pyle. I'm not one to monger rumors. I don't know if that's even the right way of saying that. But there is a little bit of a story between those two. I mean, the Pyles and the Wyeths were very intertwined. I mean, this is otherwise known as Wyeth country. And I mean, I was driving to Target today and going like, look at that hill. That looks exactly like Christina's world. You know, it's crazy that you're driving through these paintings, basically.
I mean, it's literally, I drive through an Andrew Wyeth painting every day to work. Yeah. And we have tour groups, especially the groups that come from Japan that are really doing that kind of tourism where they want to see the tree that was in that painting or the hill that was in that painting.
Do I even want to broach this? let's lightly touch upon it because I've teased it enough, I guess. But then I do want to move on to something a little bit more positive. For folks who don't know, N.C. Wyeth and his grandson were killed in a train accident, in a train collision. He was in a pickup truck with his grandson. His grandson was maybe 3, 4, 5, maybe. I'm not sure how old he was, but little. There are rumors, there are discussions, there are stories that suggest that that grandson was in fact his son by Ellen's daughter, Caroline. I read that recently, and I don't know.
And just to clarify as well for the rest of the story, Caroline was married to Nat Wyeth, who was NC's son. So this would be NC's daughter-in-law.
Yeah.
And I've heard that as well. And I don't know, I mean, as I've heard it as a rumor, there's certainly nothing in the archival record. But we also know that the Wyeths are a prolific letter-writing, record-keeping family. And, you know, there's still a lot of records out there that, you know, for various reasons, a family member might not have wanted to share with the public. And we see that we're seeing that even just now. For instance, we became the stewards of the Andrew Wyeth studio only just since I've been at the museum. He passed away in 2009 and we opened it officially to the public in 2012. And recently with the passing of Betsy Wyeth, there's even more of a sea change that one might imagine with a passing of a generation and understanding that things that were private letters or things like this are bound for historical archives as well. So it may be that it's something that is clarified later on. Also tied with those rumors is often discussions of N.C. Wyeth's his state of mind. He talked about, his children have talked about his bouts with depression. And, you know, again, not to start rumors, but if we're talking about the speculation that went around with that accident, there's often been the idea that he was facing another bout of depression when that accident occurred. Yeah. So, you know, it's in the past, right? And we can only imagine what it might have been like if any of those instances were true. But regardless of how he came to die, the fact that he, you know, the details of it, the fact that he left the world, but with such an indelible mark in illustration and with his own family of artists, it just makes it all the more, I think, meaningful to visit not just the house and the studio, but to drive the area, like you mentioned, seeing the places that this history all unfolded.
Right. Exactly. And I don't want Wyeth to listen to this, not assuming that they are, but and you know, getting upset because I just recently read about this and it upset me to think that if that were true. And you know, the Wyeths and the Piles, what would illustration be without their influence? I mean, it would be something else, and it wouldn't, I don't know if it would be better or worse, but it wouldn't be what we know it today.
You know, and even for illustrators who were not working in the vein or the style of the Pyle school, their work was influential to, and I'm thinking here actually of an exhibition I have coming up next year about the American modernist Ralston Crawford, who is much better known as a precisionist painter. Mm-hmm. But he also passed through this area. He lived in Chad's Ford, and he was exhibiting side by side with the Wyeths and the Piles, and actually did go into illustration for a little bit, book illustration and covers. And so even, you know, something out of the blue, like an American modernist that tends towards abstraction, was touched by the world of Pyle's illustration family here in our area.
Right. And I'm going to take this opportunity to mention Frank Schoonover, who I've mentioned several other occasions on the podcast, a personal favorite of mine, in a contemporary of Pyle's, and or a student of his, I think, is more accurate to say.
But
Frank Schoonover is the Dean of Delaware Artists, which is kind of a cool moniker, if you ask me.
Yeah, the, you know, as we were talking before about those things that are just, that appear on your doorstep, I was also looking today at a potential gift. Actually, I've been looking at it for a couple of weeks now, a Frank Schoonover landscape painting that is made me go, oh, Frank Schoonover played with the American Impressionists at some point. It was just, is something that I particularly like to see, is when, you know, those other styles and the experimentation that any artist also engages in. I love to look at Thomas Hart Benton's early abstract, totally abstract work and go, that's where he started. And so many, you know, other artists that began in illustration and then, you know, like all these members of the Ashcan School that we are knowing for their gritty paintings of New York City are starting as illustrators as well.
Yeah.
So the Schoonovers, that particular Schoonover, I mean, you know, this probably won't air for a while, but I am excited to bring that one to the gallery because it shows another aspect of Schoonover's work.
Yeah. It just goes to show how intertwined all of this is. I mean, how so many of them knew each other, how they were influenced by one another. They, you know, we always talk about the Rockwell Kents and the you know, Norman Rockwells, but we never really talk about the Thomas Fogartys, who, you know, Thomas Fogarty was one of the greatest illustration instructors in history. Mm-hmm. No one really mentions his name, but the, you know, Thomas Fogarty probably was hanging out with George Bridgman, and then there's the, you know, so there's like the Art Students League comes into play, and then you know, I was recently talking to Hillary Knight, you know, prominent children's book illustrator who took classes at the Art Students League. So it's all, there's this just one gigantic, beautifully illustrated tree that connects all illustrators, I kind of feel like. And I don't know, maybe that tree is on top of some hill here in the Brandywine Valley. Who knows? Wow, I'd love to keep talking to you about all this stuff. This actually is my first podcast interview in my new home.
That's
in,
right.
In Chester County. I was hoping and praying that I'd be able to talk to someone from the Brandywine as my first interview, and it happened. So I'm very thankful for that. And hopefully one day soon, my family and I will be floating around the Brandywine, just pointing at stuff, and I'll just be geeking out looking for fingerprints or, I don't know. Pipe ashes,
well,
and paintings.
I know. And the longer you live here, the more you start to recognize landmarks, the mills and the bridges that turn up.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the unspoken secret here that Brandywine and Chadsford area has been protecting for so long. The Wyeths still living in the area, Helga Testorf still living in the area. You know, we're kind of all in it together to maintain this history.
Yeah, fantastic. So as a last word, let's always remember that there are illustrators listening in on this conversation, perhaps creating future pieces for the Brandywine.
Yes.
What would you like to say to them directly?
Well, I just had my first experience with working to commission five illustrators to help us with an exhibition. And I think one of the things that museums are sorely lacking, and especially when we're looking at illustration, because it's by and large done as commission work, you know, someone else is calling the shots and telling you how it should look. But my advice would be to get as much of yourself into that work as you can, to try and have a voice or have a vision in your own work, even if it's done, you know, for someone who really wants it to look a certain way, because that's how in the future we're going to tell your story, because we want to see you in your work and not just, you know, the product or the children's book. We want to look back in 50 years and learn something about you from your work.
To learn more about the Brandywine, visit brandywine.org. If you enjoyed our conversation, please share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast, and provide a positive rating and review. Become a patron by visiting patreon.com/illustrationdept. In return, you'll receive our soft enamel pin, a reusable discount code for 10% off, and access to patron-only episodes we're calling Extra Credit. This podcast is produced by the Illustration Department, a global leader in online education for illustrators. Visit us at illustrationdept.com for class offerings, testimonials, the alumni showcase, the podcast show notes, our new forum, the bookshop, and more. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.